wine and small cakes. He served them, smiled shyly, and withdrew. Leonardo's very talented.
If you say so, madre, I know little of art.
Ezio thought that his life would consist of following in his father's footsteps, even though, deep within him, there was a rebellious and adventurous streak which he knew would sit ill in the character of a Florentine banker. In any case, like his older brother, he saw himself as a man of action, not as an artist or a connoisseur.
You know, self-expression is a vital part of understanding life, and enjoying it to the full.
She looked at him. You should find an outlet yourself, my dear.
Ezio was piqued.
I have plenty of outlets.
I mean, apart from tarts, retorted his mother, matter-of-factly.
Mother! But Maria's only answer to that was a shrug and a pursing of her lips. It would be good if you could cultivate a man like Leonardo as a friend. I think he has a promising future ahead of him.
From the look of this place, I'm inclined to disagree with you.
Don't be cheeky. They were interrupted by Leonardo's return from his inner room, carrying two boxes. He set one down on the ground.
Do you mind carrying that one? He asked Ezio.
I'd ask Agnolo, but he has to stay and guard the shop. Also, I don't think he's strong enough for this kind of work, poor dear.
Ezio stooped to pick up the box, and was surprised at how heavy it was. He almost dropped it.
Careful, warned Leonardo. The paintings in there are delicate, and your mother's just paid me good money for them.
Shall we go? Said Maria.
I can't wait to hang them. I've selected places which I hope you'll approve of, she added to Leonardo.
Ezio balked at this a little. Was a fledgling artist really worth such deference?
As they walked, Leonardo chatted amiably, and Ezio found that despite himself, he was won over by the other man's charm.
And yet there was something about him that he instinctively found disquieting, something he couldn't quite put his finger on.
A coolness? A sense of detachment from his fellow beings?
Perhaps it was just that he had his head in the clouds, like so many other artists, or so Ezio was told. But Ezio felt an instant instinctive respect for the man.
So, Ezio, what do you do? Leonardo asked him.
He works for his father, Maria replied.
Ah, a financier. Well, you were born in the right city for that.
It's a good city for artists, too, said Ezio. All those rich patrons.
There are so many of us, though, grumbled Leonardo. It's hard to attract attention. That's why I'm so indebted to your mother.
Mind you, she has a very discerning eye.
Do you concentrate on painting? Asked Ezio, thinking of the diversity he'd seen in the studio.
Leonardo looked thoughtful.
That's a hard question. To tell the truth, I'm finding it difficult to settle down to anything now I'm on my own. I adore painting, and I know I can do it, but somehow I can see the end before I get there, and that makes it hard to finish things sometimes. I have to be pushed. But that's not all. I often feel that my work lacks, I don't know, purpose. Does that make any sense?
You should have more faith in yourself, Leonardo, said Maria.
Thank you. But there are moments when I think I'd rather do more practical work, work that has a direct bearing on life. I want to understand life, how it works, how everything works.
Then you'd have to be 100 men in one, said Ezio.
If only I could be. I know what I want to explore. Architecture, anatomy, engineering even. I don't want to capture the world with my brush. I want to change it.
He was so impassioned that Ezio was more impressed than irritated. The man clearly wasn't boasting. If anything, he seemed almost tormented by the ideas that simmered within him.
Next thing, thought Ezio, is that he'll tell us he's involved with music and poetry as well.
Do you want to put that down and rest for a moment, Ezio? Leonardo asked.
It might be a bit too heavy for you.
Ezio gritted his teeth.
No, grazie. Anyway, we're almost there.
When they arrived at the Palazzo Auditore, he carried his box into the entrance hall and set it down as slowly and as carefully as his aching muscles would let him, and he was more relieved than he'd ever admit, even to himself.
Thank you, Ezio, said his mother. I think we can manage very well without you now, though, of course, if you wish to come and help with the hanging of the pictures...
Thank you, Mother. I think that's a job best left to the two of you. Leonardo held out his hand.
It was very good to meet you, Ezio. I hope our paths cross again soon.
Anch'io. You might just call one of the servants to give Leonardo a hand, Maria told him.
No, said Leonardo. I prefer to take care of this myself. Imagine if someone dropped one of the boxes.
And bending his knees, he hoisted the box Ezio had put down into the crook of his arm.
Shall we? He said to Maria.
This way, said Maria.
Goodbye, Ezio. I'll see you at dinner this evening.
Come, Leonardo. Ezio watched as they left the hall. This Leonardo was obviously one to respect. After lunch, late in the afternoon, Giulio came hurrying, as he always did, to tell him that his father required his presence in the office. Ezio hastened to follow the secretary down the long, oak-lined corridor that led to the back of the mansion.
Ah, Ezio, come in, my boy.
Giovanni's tone was serious and businesslike. He stood up behind his desk, on which two bulky letters lay, wrapped in vellum and sealed.
They say Duke Lorenzo will return tomorrow or the day after at the latest, said Ezio.
I know, but there is no time to waste. I want you to deliver these to certain associates of mine here in the city.
He pushed the letters across the desk.
Yes, father.
I also need you to retrieve a message which a carrier pigeon should have brought to the coop in the piazza at the end of the street. Try to make sure no one sees you fetch it.
I'll see to it.
Good. Come back here immediately you've finished. I have some important things I need to discuss with you.
Sir.
So this time, behave. No scrapping this time.
Ezio decided to tackle the pigeon coop first. Dusk was approaching, and he knew there'd be few people out at that time. A little later the square would be thronged with Florentines making their passeggiata. When he reached his goal, he noticed some graffiti on the wall behind and above the coop. He was puzzled. Was it recent, or had he just never been aware of it before? Carefully inscribed was a line he recognized from the Book of Ecclesiastes. He that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. A little below this, someone had added in a ruder script, Where is the prophet? But his mind soon returned to his task. He recognized the pigeon he was after instantly. It was the only one with a note attached to its leg. He detached it quickly and gently placed the bird back on its ledge. Then he hesitated. Should he read the note? It wasn't sealed. Quickly he unrolled the little scroll and found it contained nothing but a name, that of Francesco de Pazzi. Ezio shrugged. He supposed that would mean something more to his father than it did to him. Why the name of Vieri's father and one of the possible conspirators in a plot to topple the Duke of Milan, facts already known to Giovanni, should be of further significance was beyond him, unless it signified some kind of confirmation. But he had to hurry on with his work. Stashing the note in his belt pouch, he made his way to the address on the first envelope. Its location surprised him, for it was in the red light district. He'd been there often with Federico, before he had met Christina, that is, but he had never felt comfortable there. He placed a hand on his dagger hilt to reassure himself as he approached the dingy alley his father had indicated. The address turned out to be a low tavern, ill-lit and serving cheap Chianti in clay beakers. At a loss about what to do next, for there seemed to be no one about, he was surprised by a voice at his side.
You Giovanni's boy!
He turned to confront a rough-looking man whose breath smelled of onions. He was accompanied by a woman who might once have been pretty, but it looked as if 10 years on her back had rubbed most of any loveliness away. If it was left anywhere, it was in her clear, intelligent eyes.
No, you idiot, she said to the man. He just happens to look exactly like his dad.
You got something for us, said the man, ignoring her. Give it here.
Ezio hesitated. He checked the address. It was the right one.
Hand it over, friend, said the man, leaning closer.
Ezio got a full blast of his breath.
Did the man live on onions and garlic?
He placed the letter in the man's open hand, which closed round it immediately, and transferred it to a leather pouch at his side.
Good boy,
he said, and then smiled. Ezio was surprised to see that the smile gave his face a certain surprising nobility. but not his words. "And don't worry," he added, "we ain't contagious." He paused to glance at the woman. "At least I ain't." The woman laughed and punched his arm. Then they were gone.
Ezio made his way out of the alley with relief. The address on the second letter directed him to a street just west of the baptistry, a much better district, but a quiet one at this time of day. He hastened across town. Waiting for him under an arch which spanned the street was a burly man who looked like a soldier. He was dressed in what looked like leather country clothes, but he smelled clean and fresh, and he was clean-shaven.
"Over here," he beckoned.
"I have something for you," said Ezio.
"From Giovanni Auditore?"
The man spoke little above a whisper. "Si." The man glanced around, up and down the street. Only a lamplighter was visible, some distance away.
"Were you followed?"
"No. Why should I have been?"
"Never mind. Give me the letter, quickly."
Ezio handed it over.
"Things are hotting up," said the man.
"Tell your father they're making a move tonight. He should make plans to get to safety." Ezio was taken aback.
"What? What are you talking about?" "I've already said too much. Hurry home."
And the man melted into the shadows.
"Wait," Ezio called after him. "What do you mean? Come back."
But the man had gone. Ezio walked quickly up the street to the lamplighter. "What time is it?" he asked. The man screwed up his eyes and looked at the sky.
"Must be an hour since I came on duty," he said. "Makes it about the 20th hour."
Ezio made a quick calculation. He must have left his palazzo 2 hours earlier, and it would take him perhaps 20 minutes to reach home again. He took off at a run. Some awful premonition caught at his soul. As soon as he came within sight of the Auditore mansion, he knew something was wrong. There were no lights anywhere, and the great front doors stood open. He quickened his pace, calling as he ran,
"Father! Federico!"
The great hall of the palazzo stood dark and empty, but there was enough light for Ezio to see tables overturned, chairs smashed, broken crockery and glassware. Someone had torn Leonardo's paintings from the wall and slashed them with a knife. From the darkness beyond, he could hear the sound of sobbing. A woman sobbing. His mother. He started to make his way towards the sound when a shadow moved behind him, something raised above its head. Ezio twisted round and seized a heavy silver candlestick which someone was bringing down on his head. He gave a savage wrench, and his attacker let go of the candlestick with a cry of alarm. He tossed the candlestick away, out of reach, grabbed the arm of his assailant, and pulled the person towards what light there was. There was murder in his heart, and already his dagger was out.
"Oh, Ser Ezio, it's you, thank God!"
Ezio recognized the voice, and now the face, of the family housekeeper Annetta, a feisty countrywoman who'd been with the family for years.
"What has happened?" he asked Annetta,
taking both her wrists in his hands, and almost shaking her in his anguish and panic.
"They came, the city guards! They've arrested your father and Federico. They even took little Petruccio. They tore him from your mother's arms."
"Where is my mother?
Where is Claudia?"
"Here we are,"
came a shaky voice from the shadows. Claudia emerged, her mother leaning on her arm. Ezio righted a chair for his mother to sit on. In the dim light, he could see that Claudia was bleeding, her clothes dirty and torn. Maria did not acknowledge him. She sat on the chair, keening and rocking. In her hands she clutched the little pear-wood box of feathers Petruccio had given her not 2 days, a lifetime, before.
"My God, Claudia, are you all right?"
He looked at her, and anger flooded through him.
"Did they—"
"No,
I'm all right.
They roughed me up a little because they thought I could tell them where you were. But Mother—"
"Oh, Ezio. They've taken Father and Federico and Petruccio to the Palazzo Vecchio."
"Your mother's in shock," said Annetta.
"When she resisted them, they—"
She broke off.
"Bastardi!"
Ezio thought quickly. "It's not safe here."
"Is there somewhere you can take them, Annetta?"
"Yes, yes, to my sister's. They'll be safe there."
Annetta barely managed to get the words out, the fear and anguish choking her voice.
"We must move fast. The guards will almost certainly come back for me.
Claudia, Mother, there's no time to waste. Don't take anything, just go with Annetta. Now, Claudia, let Mamma lean on you. He escorted them out of their stricken home, still in shock himself, and helped them on their way before leaving them in the capable hands of the loyal Annetta, who had begun to regain her composure. Ezio's mind raced with all the implications, his world rocked by the terrible turn of events. Desperately, he tried to assess all that had happened, and just what he must do now, what he must do to save his father and brothers. Straight away, he knew that he had to find some way of seeing his father, finding out what had brought on this attack, this outrage to his family. But the Palazzo Vecchio. They'd have put his kinsmen in the two small cells in the tower, of that he was sure. Maybe there'd be a chance. But the place was fortified like a castle keep, and there'd be a redoubtable guard placed on it, tonight of all nights. Forcing himself to be calm and to think clearly, he slipped through the streets to the Piazza della Signoria, hugging its walls and looking up. Torches burned from the battlements and from the top of the tower, illuminating the giant red fleur-de-lis that was the city's emblem, and the great clock at the tower's base. Higher up, squinting to see more clearly, Ezio thought he could discern the dim light of a taper in a small barred window near the top. There were guards posted outside the palazzo's great double doors, and more on the battlements. But there were none that Ezio could see at the top of the tower, whose battlements, anyway, were above the window he needed to reach. He skirted the square away from the palazzo, and found his way to the narrow street which led off the piazza along the palazzo's north side. Fortunately, there was still a reasonable number of people about, strolling and enjoying the evening air. It seemed to Ezio that he suddenly existed in another world from theirs, that he had been cut off from the society he had swum in like a fish until only 3 or 4 short hours ago. He bristled at the thought that life could still continue in its even routine for all these people, while that of his own family had been shattered. Again, he felt his heart swell with an almost overwhelming rush of anger and fear. But then he turned his mind firmly back to the work in hand, and a look of steel crossed his face. The wall rising above him was sheer and giddyingly high, but it was in darkness, and that would be to his advantage. Moreover, the stones of which the palazzo was constructed were rough-hewn, so he would have plenty of handholds and footholds to aid him in his ascent. One problem would be any guards posted on the north side battlements, but he'd have to deal with that when he came to it. He hoped that most would be grouped along the west-facing main facade of the building. Taking a breath and glancing round, there was no one else in this dark street. He gave a leap, took a firm hold of the wall, gripped with his toes in their soft leather boots, and began to scale upwards. Once he'd reached the battlements, he dropped to a crouch, the tendons in his calves straining with tension. There were 2 guards here, but they had their backs to him, looking towards the lighted square beneath. Ezio stayed motionless for a moment, until it became clear that any sound he'd made had not alerted them to his presence. Staying low, he darted towards them, and then struck, drawing them back, one hand around each of their necks, using their own weight and the element of surprise to bring them down on their backs. In barely a heartbeat, he had their helmets off and smashed their heads together violently. They were unconscious before they could register any surprise on their faces. If that hadn't worked, Ezio knew he would have cut their throats without a second's hesitation. He paused again, breathing hard. Now for the tower. This was of more smoothly trimmed stone, and the going was hard. What's more, he had to climb round from the north to the west side of it, where the cell window was. He prayed that no one in the square or on the battlements would look up. He didn't fancy being brought down by a crossbow bolt after having got so far. The corner where the north and west walls met was hard and uncompromising, and for a moment Ezio clung there, frozen, looking for a handhold that didn't seem to exist. He looked down and saw, far beneath him, one of the guards on the battlements looking up. He could see the pale face clearly. He could see the man's eyes. He pressed himself to the wall. In his dark clothing he'd be as conspicuous as a cockroach on a white tablecloth. But, inexplicably, The man lowered his gaze and continued his patrol. Had he seen him? Had he not been able to believe what he'd seen? Ezio's throat thumped with the strain. Only able to relax after a long minute had passed, he breathed once more. After a monumental effort, he arrived at his goal, grateful for the narrow ledge on which he could just perch as he peered into the narrow cell beyond the window. God is merciful, he thought, as he recognized the figure of his father, his back turned towards him, apparently reading by the thin light of a taper. Father, he called softly. Giovanni spun round. Ezio, in God's name, how did you... Never mind, father. As Giovanni approached, Ezio could see that his hands were bloody and bruised, and his face pale and drawn. My God, father, what have they done to you? I took a bit of a beating, but I'm all right. More importantly, what of your mother and sister? Safe now. With Annetta? Yes. God be praised. What happened, father? Were you expecting this? Not as quickly as this. They arrested Federico and Petruccio, too. I think they're in the cell behind this one. If Lorenzo had been here, things would have been different. I should have taken precautions. What are you talking about? There's no time for that now. Giovanni almost shouted. Now listen to me. You must get back to our house. There's a hidden door in my office. There's a chest concealed in a chamber beyond it. Take everything you find inside it. Do you hear? Everything. Much of it will seem strange to you, but all of it is important. Yes, father. Ezio shifted his weight slightly, still clinging for dear life to the bars that crossed the window. He didn't dare look down now, and he didn't know how much longer he could remain motionless. Among the contents, you'll find a letter, and with it, some documents. You must take them without delay, tonight, to Messer Alberti.
The Gonfalonieri.
Exactly. Now go.
But, father...
Ezio struggled to get the words out, and wishing that he could do more than just ferry documents, he stammered.
Are the Pazzi behind this?
I read the note from the carrier pigeon. It said... But then Giovanni hushed him. Ezio could hear the key turning in the lock of the cell door. They're taking me for interrogation, said Giovanni, grimly. Get away before they discover you. My God, you're a brave boy. You'll be worthy of your destiny. Now, for the last time, go! Ezio edged himself off the ledge and clung to the wall out of sight as he heard his father being led away. He almost couldn't bear to listen. Then he steeled himself for the climb down. He knew that descents are almost always harder than ascents. But even in the last 48 hours he'd gained plenty of experience of scaling up and down buildings. And now he clambered down the tower, slipping once or twice, but regaining his hold, until he had reached the battlements again, where the two guardsmen still lay where he had left them. Another stroke of luck. He'd knocked their heads together as hard as he could, but if they'd chanced to regain consciousness while he was up on the tower and raised the alarm... Well, the consequences didn't bear thinking about. Indeed, there was no time to think of such things. He swung himself over the battlements and peered down. Time was of the essence. If he could see something down below which might break his fall, he might dare to leap. As his eyes adjusted to the gloom, he saw the awning of a deserted stall attached to the wall far below. Should he risk it? If he succeeded, he'd gain a few precious minutes. If he failed, a broken leg would be the least of his problems. He would have to have faith in himself. He took a deep breath and dived into the darkness. From such a height, the awning collapsed under his weight, but it had been firmly secured and gave just enough resistance to break his fall. He was winded, and he'd have a few bruised ribs in the morning, but he was down, and no alarm had been raised. He shook himself and sped off in the direction of what only hours ago had been his home. When he reached it, he realized that in his haste his father had neglected to tell him how to locate the secret door. Giulio would know, but where was Giulio now? Luckily, there had been no guards lurking in the vicinity of the house, and he'd been able to gain access unchallenged. He had stopped for a minute outside the house, almost unable to propel himself in through the darkness of the doorway. It seemed that the house had changed, its sanctity defiled. Again, Ezio had to collect his thoughts, knowing that his actions were critical. His family depended on him now. He pressed on into his family home, into the dark. Shortly afterwards, he stood in the center of the office, eerily lit by a single candle, and looked about him. The place had been turned over by the guards, who had clearly confiscated a large number of bank documents, and the general chaos of fallen bookcases, overturned chairs, drawers cast to the ground and scattered papers and books everywhere didn't make Ezio's task any easier. But he knew the office, his eyesight was keen, and he used his wits. The walls were thick, any could have a chamber concealed within them. But he made for the wall into which the large fireplace was set and started his search there, where the walls would be thickest to contain the chimney piece. Holding the candle close, and looking searchingly while keeping an ear cocked for any sound of returning guards, finally, on the left-hand side of the great moulded mantel, he thought he could discern the faint outline of a door set into the panelling. There had to be a means of opening it nearby. He looked carefully at the carved colossi which held the marble mantelpiece on their shoulders. The nose of the one on the left-hand side looked as if it had once been broken and repaired, for there was a fine crack around its base. He touched the nose and found it to be slightly loose. Heart in mouth, he moved it gently, and the door swung inwards on silent spring-mounted hinges, revealing a stone-floored corridor which led to the left. As he entered, his right foot encountered a flagstone which moved beneath it, and as it did so, oil lamps set into the passageway's walls suddenly flared into life. It ran a short way, sloping slightly downwards, and terminated in a circular chamber decorated more in the style of Syria than Italy. Ezio's mind flashed on a picture which hung in his father's private study of the castle of Masyaf, once the seat of the ancient order of assassins. But he had no time to ponder whether or not this curious decor could be of any special significance. The room was unfurnished, and in its centre stood a large, iron-bound chest, securely sealed with two heavy locks. He looked around the room to see if a key might be anywhere, but aside from its ornamentation, it was bare. Ezio was wondering if he'd have to return to the office, or make his way to his father's study to search for one there, and if he'd have time to do so, when by chance his hand brushed against one of the locks, and at that it sprang open. The other one opened as easily. Had his father given him some power he did not know of? Were the locks in some way programmed to respond to a certain person's touch? Mystery was piling on mystery, but there was no time to dwell on them now. He opened the chest and saw that it contained a white hood, evidently old, and made of some, perhaps, woolen material which he didn't recognize. Something compelled him to put it on, and at once a strange power surged through him. He lowered the hood, but did not take it off. The chest contained a leather bracer, a cracked dagger blade connected, instead of to a hilt, to a strange mechanism whose workings were beyond him, a sword, a page of vellum covered with symbols and letters and what looked like part of a plan, and the letter and documents his father had told him to take to Uberto Alberti. He gathered them all up, closed the chest, and retreated to his father's office, closing the secret door carefully behind him. In the office, he found a discarded document pouch of Giulio's and stashed the contents of the chest in it, slinging the pouch across his chest. He buckled on the sword. Not knowing what to make of this strange collection of objects, and not having time to reflect on why his father would keep such things in a secret chamber, he made his way cautiously back towards the main doors of the palazzo. But just as he entered the forecourtyard, he saw two city guards on their way in. It was too late to hide. They had seen him. "Halt!" one of them cried, and they both began advancing quickly towards him. There was no retreat. Ezio saw that they had already drawn their swords. "What are you here for? To arrest me?" "No," said the one who had spoken first. "Our orders are to kill you." At that, the second guard rushed him. Ezio drew his own sword as they closed in on him. It was a weapon he was unfamiliar with, but it felt light and capable in his hand, and it was as if he had used it all his life. He parried the first thrusts, right and left, both guards lunging at him at the same time. Sparks flew from all three swords, but Ezio felt his new blade hold firm, the edge biting and keen. Just as the second guard was bringing his sword down to sever Ezio's arm from his shoulder, Ezio feinted right under the incoming blade. He shifted his balance from back to front foot and lunged. The guard was caught off balance as his sword arm thudded harmlessly against Ezio's shoulder. Ezio used his own momentum to thrust his new sword up, piercing the man directly through the heart. Standing tall, Ezio rocked on the balls of his feet, raised his left foot, and pushed the dead guard off his blade in time to swivel round to confront his companion. The other guard came forward with a roar, wielding a heavy sword.
"Prepare to die, traditore!"
"I am no traitor, nor is any member of my family." The guard swung at him, tearing at his left sleeve and drawing blood. Ezio winced, but only for a second. The guard pressed forward, seeing an advantage, and Ezio allowed him to lunge once more, then, stepping back, tripped him, swinging his own sword unflinchingly and very hard at the man's neck as he fell, and severing his head from his shoulders before he hit the ground. For a moment, Ezio stood trembling in the sudden silence that followed the melee, breathing hard. These were the first killings of his life. Or were they? For he felt another, older life within him, a life which seemed to have years of experience in death-dealing. The sensation frightened him. This night had seen him age far beyond his years, but this new sensation seemed to be the awakening of some darker force deep within him. It was something more than simply the effect of the harrowing experiences of the last few hours. His shoulders sagged as he made his way through the darkened streets to Alberti's mansion, starting at every sound and looking behind him frequently. At last, on the edge of exhaustion, but able somehow to bear up, he arrived at the Gonfalonieri's home. He looked up at the facade and saw a dim light in one of the front windows. He knocked hard on the door with the pommel of his sword. Receiving no answer, nervous and impatient, he knocked again, harder and louder. Still nothing. But at the third time of trying, a hatch in the door opened briefly, then closed. The door swung open almost immediately thereafter, and a suspicious armed servant admitted him. He blurted out his business, and was conducted to a first-floor room where Alberti sat at a desk covered with papers. Beyond him, half turned away and sitting in a chair by a dying fire, Ezio thought he could see another man, tall and powerful. But only part of his profile was visible, and that indistinctly. "Ezio?" Alberti stood up, surprised. "What are you doing here at this hour?"
I don't...
Alberti approached him and put a hand on his shoulder. "Wait, child. Take a breath. Collect your thoughts." Ezio nodded. Now he felt safer, he also felt more vulnerable. The events of the evening and night since he had set out to deliver Giovanni's letters were catching up with him. From the brass pedestal clock on the desk, he could see that it was close to midnight. Could it really only be 12 hours since Ezio the boy had gone with his mother to collect paintings from an artist's studio? Despite himself, he felt close to tears. But he collected himself, and it was Ezio the man who spoke. "My father and brothers have been imprisoned. I do not know on whose authority. My mother and sister are in hiding, and our family seat is ransacked. My father enjoined me to deliver this letter and these papers to you." Ezio drew the documents from his pouch.
"Thank you."
Alberti put on a pair of eyeglasses and took Giovanni's letter to the light of the candle burning on his desk. There was no sound in the room apart from the ticking of the clock and the occasional soft crash as the embers of the fire collapsed on themselves. If there was another presence in the room, Ezio had forgotten it. Alberti now turned his attention to the documents. He took some time over them, and finally placed one of them discreetly inside his black doublet. The others he put carefully to one side, apart from the other papers on his desk.
"There's been a terrible misunderstanding, my dear Ezio," he said, taking off his spectacles. "It's true that allegations were laid, serious allegations, and that a trial has been scheduled for tomorrow morning. But it seems that someone may have been, perhaps for reasons of their own, overly zealous. But don't worry, I'll clear everything up."
Ezio hardly dared to believe him. "How?"
"The documents you've given me contain evidence of a conspiracy against your father and against the city. I'll present these papers at the hearing in the morning, and Giovanni and your brothers will be released. I guarantee it."
Relief flooded through the young man. He clasped the Gonfalonieri's hand. "How can I thank you?"
"The administration of justice is my job, Ezio. I take it very seriously, and..."
For a fraction of a second, he hesitated.
"Your father is one of my dearest friends."
Alberti smiled.
"But where are my manners? I haven't even offered you a glass of wine."
He paused.
"And where will you spend the night?"
"I still have some urgent business to attend to, but my servants will see that you have food and drink and a warm bed." At the time, Ezio didn't know why he refused so kind an offer. It was well after midnight by the time he left the Gonfalonieri's mansion. Pulling up his hood again, he prowled through the streets, trying to arrange his thoughts. Presently, he knew where his feet were taking him. Once there, he climbed to the balcony with greater ease than he'd imagined possible. Perhaps urgency lent strength to his muscles, and knocked gently on her shutters, calling quietly, "Christina, amore, wake up, it's me." He waited, silent as a cat, and listened. He could hear her stirring, rising, and then her voice, scared, on the other side of the shutters.
"Who is it?"
"Ezio."
She opened the shutters swiftly.
"What is it? What's wrong?"
"Let me come in, please." Sitting on her bed, he told her the whole story.
"I knew something was amiss," she said. "My father seemed troubled this evening. But it does sound as if all will be well."
"I need you to let me stay here tonight. Don't worry, I'll be gone long before dawn. And I need to leave something with you for safekeeping." He unslung his pouch and placed it between them. "I must trust you."
"Oh, Ezio, of course you can."
He fell into a troubled sleep in her arms. Chapter 4. It was a grey and overcast morning, and the city felt oppressed with the muggy heat that was trapped by the overhanging cloud. Ezio arrived at the Piazza della Signoria and saw, to his intense surprise, that a dense crowd had gathered already. A platform had been erected, and on it was placed a table covered with a heavy brocade cloth bearing the arms of the city. Standing behind it were Uberto Alberti and a tall, powerfully built man with a beaky nose and careful, calculating eyes, dressed in robes of rich crimson, a stranger to Ezio at least. But his attention was caught by the sight of the other occupants of the platform, his father and his brothers, all in chains. And just beyond them stood a tall construction with a heavy crossbeam from which three nooses were suspended. Ezio had arrived at the piazza in a mood of anxious optimism. Had not the Gonfalonieri told him that all would be resolved this day? Now his feelings changed. Something was wrong. Badly wrong. He tried to push his way forward, but could not press through the mob. He felt the claustrophobia threatened to overwhelm him. Desperately trying to calm down, to rationalize his actions, he paused, drew his hood close over his head, and adjusted the sword at his belt. Surely Alberti would not let him down. And all the time he noticed that the tall man, a Spaniard by his dress, his face, and his complexion, was ranging the mass of people with those piercing eyes. Who was he? Why did he stir something in Ezio's memory? Had he seen him somewhere before? The Gonfalonieri, resplendent in his robes of office, raised his arms to quieten the people, and instantly a hush fell over them. "Giovanni Auditore," said Alberti in a commanding tone which failed, to Ezio's acute ear, to conceal a note of fear. "You and your accomplices stand accused of the crime of treason. Have you any evidence to counter this charge?" Giovanni looked at once surprised and uneasy. "Yes, you have it all in the documents that were delivered to you last night." But Alberti said, "I know of no such documents, Auditore." Ezio saw at once that this was a show trial, but he couldn't understand what looked like deep treachery on Alberti's part. He shouted, "It's a lie!" But his voice was drowned by the roar of the crowd. He struggled to get closer, shoving angry citizens aside, but there were too many of them, and he was trapped in their midst. Alberti was speaking again. "The evidence against you has been amassed and examined. It is irrefutable. In the absence of any proof to the contrary, I am bound by my office to pronounce you and your accomplices, Federico and Petruccio, and, in absentia, your son Ezio, guilty of the crime you stand accused of." He paused as the crowd once more fell silent. "I hereby sentence you all to death, the sentence to be carried out immediately." The crowd roared again. At a signal from Alberti, the hangman prepared the nooses, while two of his assistants took first little Petruccio, who was fighting back tears, to the gallows. The rope was placed round his neck as he prayed rapidly, and the attendant priest shook holy water onto his head. Then the executioner pulled a lever set into the scaffold, and the boy dangled, kicking the air until he was still. "No," mouthed Ezio, barely able to believe what he was seeing. "No, God, please, no!" But his words were choked in his throat, his loss overcoming all. Federico was next, bellowing his innocence and that of his family, struggling in vain to break loose from the guards who wrestled him towards the gallows. Ezio, now beside himself, striving desperately forward again, saw a solitary tear roll down his father's ashen cheek. Aghast, Ezio watched as his older brother and greatest friend jolted at the rope's end. It took longer for him to leave the world than it had taken Petruccio, but at last he, too, was still, swaying from the gallows. You could hear the wooden crossbeam creak in the silence. Ezio fought with the disbelief within him. Could this really be happening? The crowd began to murmur, but then a firm voice stilled it. Giovanni Auditore was speaking. "It is you who are the traitor, Uberto. You, one of my closest associates and friends, in whom I entrusted my life. And I am a fool. I did not see that you are one of them." Here he raised his voice to a great cry of anguish and of rage. "You may take our lives this day, but mark this, we will have yours in return." He bowed his head and fell silent. A deep silence, interrupted only by the murmured prayers of the priest, followed as Giovanni Auditore walked with dignity to the gallows and commended his soul to the last great adventure it would travel on. Ezio was too shocked to feel grief at first. It was as if a great iron fist had slammed into him. But as the trap opened below Giovanni, he couldn't help himself. "Father!" he cried, his voice cracking. Instantly the Spaniard's eyes were on him. Was there something supernatural about the man's vision, to pick him out in such a throng? As if in slow motion, Ezio saw the Spaniard lean towards Alberti, whisper something, and point. "Guards!" shouted Alberti, pointing as well. "There! That's another one of them! Seize him!" Before the crowd could react and restrain him, Ezio muscled through it to its edge, smashing his fists into anyone who stood barring his way. A guard was already waiting for him, He snatched at Ezio, pulling back his hood. Acting now on some instinctive drive within him, Ezio wrenched free and drew his sword with one hand, grabbing the guard by the throat with the other. Ezio's reaction had been far faster than the guard had anticipated, and before he could bring his arms up to defend himself, Ezio tightened his grip on both throat and sword, and in one swift punching movement ran the guard through, slicing the sword in the body as he drew it out, so that the man's intestines spilled from under his tunic onto the cobblestones. He threw the body aside and turned to the rostrum, fixing Alberti with his eye.
"I will kill you for this!"
he screamed, his voice straining with hatred and rage. But other guards were closing in. Ezio, his instinct for survival taking over, sped away from them towards the comparative safety of the narrow streets beyond the square. To his dismay, he saw two more guards, swift of foot, rushing to cut him off. They confronted each other at the edge of the square. The two guards faced him, blocking his retreat, the others closing in behind. Ezio fought them both frantically. Then an unlucky parry from one of them knocked his sword out of his hand. Fearing that this was the end, Ezio turned to flee from his attackers, but before he could find his feet, something astonishing happened. From the narrow street he was making for, and was within a few feet of, a roughly dressed man appeared. With lightning speed he came up on the two guards from behind, and with a long dagger cut deep under the pits of their sword arms, tearing through tendons and rendering them useless. He moved so fast that Ezio could scarcely follow his movements as he retrieved the young man's fallen sword and threw it to him. Ezio suddenly recognized him, and smelled once more the stench of onions and garlic. At that moment, damask roses couldn't have smelled sweeter.
"Get out of here," said the man,
and then he too was gone. Ezio plunged down the street and ducked off it down alleys and lanes he knew intimately from his nightly forays with Federico. The hue and cry behind him faded. He made his way down to the river and found refuge in a disused watchman's shack behind one of the warehouses belonging to Christina's father. In that hour, Ezio ceased to be a boy and became a man. The weight of the responsibility he now felt he carried to avenge and correct this hideous wrong fell on his shoulders like a heavy cloak. Slumping down on a pile of discarded sacks, he felt his whole body begin to shake. His world had just been torn apart. His father, Federico, and, God, no, little Petruccio, all gone, all dead, all murdered. Holding his head in his hands, he broke down, unable to control the pouring out of sorrow, fear, and hatred. Only after several hours was he able to uncover his face, his eyes bloodshot and run through with an unbending vengeance. At that moment, Ezio knew his former life was over. Ezio the boy was gone forever. From now, his life was forged for one purpose, and one purpose alone. Revenge. Much later in the day, knowing full well that the watch would still be out looking for him relentlessly, he made his way via back alleys to Christina's family mansion. He didn't want to put her in any danger, but he needed to collect his pouch with its precious contents. He waited in a dark alcove that stank of urine, not moving even when rats scuttled at his feet, until a light in her window told him that she had retired for the night. "Ezio," she cried as she saw him on her balcony. "Thank God you're alive." Her face flooded with relief, but that was short-lived, grief taking over. "Your father and brothers." She couldn't finish the sentence, and her head bowed. Ezio took her in his arms, and for several minutes they just stood holding each other. Finally, she broke away. "You're mad. What are you still doing in Florence?" "I still have matters to attend to," he said grimly. "But I cannot stay here long. It's too big a risk for your family. If they thought you were harboring me..." Christina was silent. "Give me my satchel and I'll be gone." She fetched it for him, but before she gave it to him, said, "What about your family?" "That is my first duty. to bury my dead. I can't see them thrown into a lime pit like common criminals.
I know where they have taken them.
How?
The town's been talking all day.
But no one will be there now. They're down near the Porta San Nicolo, with the bodies of paupers. There's a pit prepared, and they're waiting for the lime carts to come in the morning.
Oh, Ezio.
Ezio spoke calmly but grimly. I must see to it that my father and my brothers have a fitting departure from this earth. I cannot offer them a requiem mass, but I can spare their bodies in dignity.
I'll come with you.
No. Do you realize what it would mean if you were caught with me? Christina lowered her eyes. I must see that my mother and sister are safe too. And I owe my family one more death. He hesitated. Then I will leave. Perhaps forever. The question is, will you come with me? She drew back, and he could see a host of conflicting emotions in her eyes. Love was there, deep and lasting. But he had grown so much older than she since they had first held each other in their arms. She was still a girl. How could he expect her to make such a sacrifice?
I want to, Ezio. You don't know how much. But my family... It would kill my parents.
Ezio looked at her gently. Though they were the same age, his recent experience had made him suddenly far more mature than she was. He had no family to depend on any more. Just responsibility and duty. And it was hard. I was wrong to ask. And who knows, perhaps some day when all this is behind us. He put his hands to his neck, and from the folds of his collar withdrew a heavy silver pendant on a fine chain of gold. He took it off. The pendant bore a simple design, just the initial letter A of his family name. I want you to have this. Take it, please. With trembling hands she accepted it, crying softly. She looked down at it, then up at him, to thank him, to make some further excuse. But he was gone. On the south bank of the Arno, near the Porta San Nicolo, Ezio found the bleak place where the bodies were arranged next to a huge, gaping pit. Two sorry-looking guards, raw recruits by the look of them, patrolled nearby, dragging their halberds as much as carrying them. The sight of their uniforms aroused Ezio's anger, and his first instinct was to kill them. But he had seen enough of death that day, and these were just country boys who'd stumbled into uniforms for want of anything better. It caught at his heart when he saw his father's and his brother's bodies lying near the edge of the pit, still with their nooses round their scorched necks. But he could see that once the guards fell asleep, as they surely soon would, he could carry the corpses to the river's edge, where he had prepared an open boat, which he'd loaded with brushwood. It was about the third hour, and the first faint light of dawn was already bleaching the eastern sky by the time he had completed his task. He stood alone on the riverbank, watching as the boat bearing his kinsmen's bodies, all aflame, drifted slowly with the current towards the sea. He watched until the light of the fire flickered away into the distance. He made his way back to the city. A hard resolve had overcome his grief. There was still much to do, but first he must rest. He returned to the watchman's shack and made himself as comfortable as he could. Some little sleep would not be denied, but even as he slept, Christina would not leave his thoughts or dreams. He knew the approximate whereabouts of the house of Annetta's sister, though he had never been there, or indeed met Paola. But Annetta had been his wet nurse, and he knew that if he could trust no one else, he could trust her. He wondered if she knew, as she must, of the fate that had befallen his father and brothers, and if so, whether she had told his mother and sister. He approached the house with great care, using an indirect route, and covering the distance where he could by running at a crouch over rooftops in order to avoid the busy streets where, he was sure, Uberto Alberti would have his men searching. Ezio could not rid himself of the thought of Alberti's treachery. What faction had his father referred to on the gallows? What could induce Alberti to bring about the death of one of his closest allies? Paola's house lay in a street just north of the cathedral, Ezio knew. But when he got there, he didn't know which it was. There were few signs hanging from the fronts of the buildings here to identify them, and he could not afford to loiter in case he was recognized. He was about to depart when he saw Annetta herself, coming from the direction of the Piazza San Lorenzo. Pulling his hood down so that his face was shadowed, he made his way to meet her, making himself walk at a normal pace, trying as best he could to blend in with his fellow citizens as they went about their business. He passed Annetta herself, and was gratified that she did not give any sign that she had noticed him. A few yards on, he doubled back and fell into step just behind her. Annetta. She had the wit not to turn round. Ezio, you're safe. I wouldn't say that. And my mother and sister, they are protected. Oh, Ezio, your poor father, and Federico, and... She stifled a sob. Little Petruccio. I've just come from San Lorenzo. I lit a candle to San Antonio for them. They say the Duke will be here soon. Perhaps... Do my mother and Maria know what has happened? We thought it best to keep that knowledge from them. Ezio thought for a moment. It is best so. I will tell them when the time is right. He paused. Will you take me to them? I couldn't identify your sister's house. I'm on my way there now. Stay close and follow me. He fell back a little, but kept her in sight. The establishment she entered had the grim, fortress-like facade of so many of the grander Florentine buildings, but once inside, Ezio was taken aback. This was not quite what he had expected. He found himself in a richly decorated parlour of great size and high-ceilinged. It was dark, and the air was close. Velvet hangings in dark reds and deep browns covered the walls, interspersed with oriental tapestries depicting scenes of unequivocal luxury and sexual pleasure. The room was illuminated by candlelight, and a smell of incense hung in the air. The furniture mainly consisted of deep-seated daybeds covered with cushions of the costly brocade, and low tables on which there were trays bearing wine in silver carafes, Venetian glasses, and golden bowls of sweetmeats. But what was most surprising were the people in the room. A dozen beautiful girls wearing silks and satins in green and yellow, cut in the Florentine fashion, but with skirts slit to the top of the thigh, and plunging necklines that left nothing to the imagination except the promise of where it should not venture. Around three walls of the room, beneath the hangings and tapestries, a number of doors could be seen. Ezio looked round, in a sense, not knowing where to look. "Are you sure this is the right place?" he asked Annetta. "Ma certo, and here is my sister to greet us." An elegant woman who must have been in her late 30s but looked 10 years younger, as beautiful as any principessa and better dressed than most, was coming towards them from the centre of the room. There was a veiled sadness in her eyes, which somehow increased the sexual charge she transmitted, and Ezio, for all else that was on his mind, found himself stirred. She extended her long-fingered, bejewelled hand to him. "It is a pleasure to make your acquaintance, Messer Auditore." She looked at him appraisingly. "Annetta speaks quite highly of you." "And now I can see why." Ezio, blushing despite himself, replied, "I appreciate the kind words, Madonna. Please, call me Paola." Ezio bowed. "I cannot sufficiently express my gratitude to you for extending your protection to my mother and sister, Paola. It was the least I could do. Are they here? May I see them?" "They are not here. This would be no place for them, and some of my clients are highly placed in the city's governance. Is this place, then, forgive me, but is it what I think it is? Paola laughed. Of course. But I hope it is rather different from those stews down by the docks. It is really too early for business, but we like to be ready. There's always the chance of the occasional caller on his way to the office. Your timing is perfect. Where is my mother? Where is Claudia? They are safe, Ezio. But it's too risky to take you to see them now, and we mustn't compromise their security. She drew him to a sofa and sat down with him. Annetta, meanwhile, disappeared into the bowels of the house on some business of her own. I think it will be best, Paola continued, for you to leave Florence with them at the earliest opportunity. But you must rest first. You must gather your strength, for you have a long and arduous road ahead of you. Perhaps you'd like... You are kind, Paola, he interrupted her gently. And you are right in what you suggest. But just now I cannot stay. Why? Where are you going? During their conversation, Ezio had been growing ever calmer as all his racing thoughts came crashing together. At last he found himself able to shrug off his shock and his fear, for he had come to a decision and found a purpose, both of which he knew were irrevocable. I'm going to kill Uberto Alberti, he said. Paola looked worried. I understand your desire for vengeance. But the Gonfaloniere is a powerful man, and you're not a natural killer, Ezio. Fate is making me one, he thought. But he said, as politely as he could, spare me the lecture, for he was bent on his mission. Paola ignored him and completed her sentence, but I can make you one. Ezio fought down suspicion. And why would you want to teach me how to kill? She shook her head. In order to teach you how to survive. I'm not sure that I need any training from you. She smiled. I know how you feel. But please allow me to hone the skills I'm sure you have naturally. Think of my teaching as an extra weapon in your armory. She started his training that very day, recruiting those girls who were off duty and trusted house servants to help her. In the high-walled garden behind the house, she organized 20 of her people into 5 groups of 4. They then started to mill around the garden, crisscrossing each other, talking and laughing, some of the girls casting bold looks on Ezio and smiling. Ezio, who still carried his precious pouch at his side, was immune to their charms. Now, Paola told him, discretion is paramount in my profession. We must be able to walk the streets freely, seen